Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Smarty Pants, the podcast of the American Scholar magazine. I'm your host, Stephanie Bastek. Phil Clay won the National Book Award in 2014 for Redeployment, a collection of short stories drawn from his own deployment in Iraq as a public affairs officer for the Marines. He wrote an essay for our winter issue, Tales of War and Redemption, in which he quotes from German theology and idly mentions paging through the sermons of medieval English abbots. But he opens talking about a graphic novel for kids, The Big Book of Martyrs, which, to quote him, depicts various saints and their horrible, horrible deaths, where God provides the good old walk-around bleeding horribly for days miracle or the rapid gross body hair growth miracle before God gets distracted and the saints die. Horribly. It's a very funny start to an essay that seems like it'll keep rolling on with a droll analysis of Catholic contradictions. And then Phil Clay reminds you that he's been to war. And he's seen horrible deaths and horrible suffering, and that whether you're young or old or a saint or wicked has no effect on when and how you'll die in war, in life. And what follows is a beautiful, moving look at suffering, not as sacrifice or atonement or something to strive for or even to cynically accept as the way the world works, but as a reminder of its inverse, joy, the joy at a life lived, and the joy, too, that is snuffed out by suffering. It's a thorny essay to unravel, and Clay is candid about his own contradictions, that the suffering of the children dying in Iraq was exacerbated by the American military, but also alleviated, that life can be so much less dramatic than death, than war, and that such a brutally honest essay was inspired by recalling a boyhood spent reading the gory tales of saints. Phil Clay joined us from New York to talk about tales of war and redemption. Thanks for joining us, Phil.
Thank you.
So we actually had a copy of the Big Book of Martyrs around from our fact check of your essay, and you did not misrepresent the horrible deaths of the saints.
It's something else, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I just skimmed through and read a couple, and I was like, well, that's really... I can see why an 11-year-old would be attracted to this. So what struck you first when you read this as an 11-year-old? What drew you as, I guess, like a young Christian boy to these stories?
Oh, I mean, I don't think that my Christianity had much to do with it at all. I think I liked the comic book art and the drama of the stories. You know, there's certainly some dramatic, violent stories in there.
Yeah, to put it mildly. So in your essay for us, The Big Book of Martyrs is this door to a bigger discussion of faith in the midst of human failings and specifically in war. And what I think is so interesting about the essay is that the spin that you give on the martyrs is less about what they have to show us about faith or their conviction in God and more about suffering, about how it just affects everybody.
Yeah, and it's also about, I think, trying to think seriously about the way those stories would have been used, right? And You know, when you read especially some of the really old martyr tales that are kind of have a mythological feel to them, you know, reading them in the current day, they just seem like kind of ridiculous stories. And yet I think that it's fairly obvious that these were deeply important to people, that they seemed to speak to certain truths of human experience that had not just something to do with suffering, but how people folded that suffering into a broader sense of what this world is and how we best approach it. And so trying to check the kind of modern, skeptical, suspicious faculties and think more deeply about what kind of human experience these kind of stories could talk to us about. What is worth dying for and what is worth suffering for? I think whether you're sort of religious or not, if if you lose that sense, you lose an important aspect of what it is to be human.
And you talk about when you read this later as an adult coming back to it in the not comic version, reading it a little bit differently from when you'd first seen it as a kid, how when you were a kid, this seemed like ridiculous, like, God, come on, you only can go halfway. You can only like save them kind of the way and then they die.
That's the one theme that really struck me is like, you know, God will save Saint Sebastian from, you know, being, you know, shot to death. And then he gets bludgeoned to death later, you know. You know, there's all these miracles that save saints, but it's like, you know, for like a minute. Or, you know, Saint Lucy, they're trying to like drag her off and God is protecting her and protecting her and protecting her. And then, you know, it's like he looks away and they, you know, like stab her eyes out and murder her. And you sort of wonder, like, what what is going on? You know, if you went through the trouble of, you know, doing these miraculous miracles to protect your saints up to a point, why do all these stories still end in not just death, but pretty horrible death? And it just seems silly to me at the, you know, as a kid.
So as an adult looking back on these tales, what changed for you? You got older, of course, but you also joined the military.
My deployment was not particularly tough, right? Personally, I was a public affairs officer, right? So I was a staff officer. But one thing that, you know, I definitely changed my perspective on these things with time was some of the actions that were taken by my chaplain, Chaps McLaughlin, who... you know, one of his duties was taking care of the people at TQ Surgical, which was a large surgical facility in Anbar province, right? It was a life, limb, and eyesight-saving facility. So, you know, when you had injured people coming in from the battlefield, and not just Marines, but also sometimes you'd have Iraqis, the staff there would take care of them, try and stabilize them, and send them on to a higher level of care. First month that I was there, we had a truck bomb explode outside our main gate. And I, you know, remember this just huge mass casualty event. We're, you know, bringing in kids on stretchers. And the surgeons actually ran out of trauma tables. And so they were actually doing surgery on the floor, right? And in a situation like that, military triage goes into effect. So you need to, you know, prioritize the most urgent cases. And if you have a case where there's nothing that can be done, this person is going to die, you do what you can to make them comfortable, but then you move on to you know, to people that you can save. But you also don't want to just leave somebody alone while they're dying. And particularly, I think, one of the things that hit everybody really hard was seeing what happened to children in war. And my chaplain, Chaps McLaughlin, a great guy, he took it upon himself to minister to kids as they were dying. He's a father himself. And after the first two kids, the Seabees made him rocking chairs, combat rocking chairs, they called them, so he could, you know, sit in these rocking chairs and hold kids while they died. And he did that for 11 kids while he was in Iraq.
Yeah. That was one of the harder parts of your essay to read. you paint such a vivid picture of that. And you write about how afterwards you talked to Chaps about that time a lot by email.
Yeah.
And he also wrote a book about his experience in war, which you quote in the essay. Mm-hmm. And it seems like your response to that time was a little bit different from the way that he responded to that experience.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of a revelation for me because I didn't have a sense of how the experience affected him. And the experience really caused some pretty searching reflections on his part about what his relationship and responsibility to this was, and how he, as a religious person, as a human being, is supposed to respond and feel about his participation in a war, where horribly injured and dying children is one of the things that happens. Whereas at the time is, much younger, and to me, particularly because during the time that I was in Iraq, things got better, right? The level of violence went down. The surge of American troops in concert with the Anbar Awakening led to a significant decline in violence in the province. And so it felt like what we were doing, far from the sort of civilian deaths as being something that implicated me, was something that justified me, right? The first, horribly injured Iraqi child that I saw had been injured by a suicide truck bomb set by, the people, very people that we were fighting. And so it seemed to me that I didn't have to have the kind of reflections that Chaps McLaughlin did. I remember coming back and getting into an argument with somebody of a more anti-war bent, and they were trying to throw the civilian deaths in Iraq in my face, as saying, like, how could you be part of this? Look at the suffering that's been caused by this war. And me responding, like, I've actually carried stretchers with injured Iraqi children, right, to treatment. What have you done? And that was sort of how I felt at the time, right? That because of the very awfulness of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, it kind of simplified what I perceived as the kind of moral questions about the war. I later talked to a special forces guy about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was actually very interesting because even though for a lot of Americans, Afghanistan is the kind of war that they understood more, right? We'd been attacked. The Taliban was sheltering Al-Qaeda. And Iraq was the bad war, the war that was based on weapons of mass destruction that never materialized. For him, fighting in Afghanistan felt really kind of just morally troublesome because he was in a special forces unit that was going out to the same valleys every year and just getting into big gnarly firefights. And just chewing up, the latest wave of new Taliban recruits, and they, were never coming with money for roads or schools or anything like that because, we didn't have it. There wasn't a lot of interest in doing that in the middle part of the last decade. Whereas in Iraq, and he said to me, the thing about, like even as screwed up as the war was, the thing about Al-Qaeda is that they always did make it easy, right? Like they were so awful. The things that they did were so despicable that it simplified things for you, right? It made it seem as though what you were doing was very morally clear, right? And you didn't have to think so deeply about how you might be implicated in the after effects of violence. The question that I think about increasingly is, if at a time when we'd cut back non-military aid to Iraq, right? Obama, after 2014, cut economic assistance in half. And we're only ramping up military engagement. What does it mean when your primary engagement with another country is through the use of violence, right? Even if in the moment it seems as though what you're doing makes perfect sense. And each individual action seems like it has a very clear kind of set of moral stakes and that you're in the right. what are the longer term after effects and how do you have to think about that? And also, how does it change you to be a part of something where, you know, the upshot is going to be violence in civilian areas?
Right, right. You say that at one point, it, you know, rather than challenging your Christian faith or provoking deep questions about who you were as a man or what kind of war you were in, it didn't really seem like you had to justify yourself at all. Did you
right.
change at any point? Like what tipped it for you that you eventually, I guess, lost that moral simplicity that Special Forces guy was talking about?
Well, I mean, one thing, it was thinking more deeply about the war and learning more about it, following the course of what's happened in Iraq, obviously makes that very complicated, right? I certainly felt pretty good about what happened at the end of my deployment because violence had gone down so much. And a year later in 2009, the New York Times had this story about a rave on the banks of Lake Habania. So I was on the banks of Lake Habania, and there was this town that I actually went on a patrol with an Army National Guard unit through. And they had thrown this rave. There was like a DJ. There were, you know, kids playing in the water, and the DJ is like playing Syrian pop music going like, who here's from, you know, Adamia? Who's here from Sadr City, right? And a buddy of mine, he's also a Marine writer, Michael Petrie, talks about seeing that article and thinking like, what the heck? Like, did we win? You know, like that's what we wanted. We wanted it to be safe enough to throw a rave on the banks of Lake Habania and have kids from all over Iraq just having a good time. And then, of course, not that much later, you have the rise of ISIS. Mm-hmm. And so events in Iraq certainly changed things, further reflection. And then also just getting older and becoming a father. I have two sons now. And I talk about in the piece my first Memorial Day as a father and, you know, holding my little baby, rocking him, and thinking about the Marines, you know, that I knew who had died, and thinking about them not just as Marines, as the people that I had known, but also as sons, right? And then thinking about the Iraqi kids that I'd seen, who never had a chance at adult life.
Right. At the end of the piece, you sort of return back to the Book of Martyrs and sort of the feeling of sort of viewing it in a different light now and seeing this relationship between all of the suffering and then joy. Can you talk a bit more about that,
yeah.
about what joy means to you and what that relationship is?
Yeah, joy is... It's not a moment of simple contentment. The poet Jeffrey Hill distinguishes between joy and enjoyment, right? Enjoyment is possessive. Enjoyment says, you know, you please me in my current mood. I think joy is more about a kind of openness. And the thing about the Martyrs' Tales is seeing them not as people seeking death and seeking suffering, but that the suffering comes as a consequence of them seeking joy, right? In the context of a world that is brutal. You know, one of the things that changed for me being a father and relating to those stories differently was that, you know, sort of the suffering that I saw, it was easy to view abstractly and to view it as, you know, something that I could kind of ledger up, right? Here is the suffering that happened as expressed in statistics at the beginning of my deployment to Iraq, and here is the you know, substantially less amount of violence in Anbar province at the end. And so if you work out that tally versus paying close attention to, you know, the weight of a individual human life, and understanding that weight isn't simply about understanding the suffering that could happen, right? Which happens in the context of war, often in a flash and a bang, and then in a sometimes slow and drawn out death in a combat hospital, but also in terms of you know, the joy
that such a life brings and the promise that it has within the context of a family and a community.
Phil Clay's essay, Tales of War and Redemption, ran in our winter issue, which you can still grab on newsstands or on our website, theamericanscholar.org. There's a link on our episode page, along with a list of writers, Christian or otherwise, veteran or not, whom Phil suggests reading after this. So thanks for listening. Next week, we'll be talking about Kraft, which, as our guest will tell you, ain't your childhood arts and crafts. Till then, take care and stay sharp.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.